You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 127. And with me tonight, I have Joe Montague, Kelly Taylor, and Mick Masilovic. How are you all tonight?
Just fine.
You're doing great. Thanks, Rod.
Okay, Kelly, why don't you start off with the introductions, and we'll go to Joe and Mick, and you can each introduce yourself in your own voices.
Good evening. My name is Kelly Taylor. I've got, I've lost count, maybe 22 years nuclear experience in operations, engineering, and licensing. Who's next?
This is Joe Montague, counting education. I'm coming up on 30 years nuclear experience, mostly utility, mostly fuel. Doing a little training in the past year, giving it, not taking it.
I guess this is Mick Masilovic. I've been in the nuclear field since 92, so I guess I've got the least amount of nuclear experience, just over, 16 years. I've done everything from working maintenance at the power plants to working on the enrichment side, and now I'm working on hopefully the mining side as well. So I've kind of got a chance to see the full fuel cycle, and I've also worked outside the nuclear fuel sector on fossil plants as well.
Well, you go, Mick. If you have the fewest years, at least nobody can accuse you of having 1 year 16 times. You've certainly got a wide variety of experience there.
So Mick is not into Groundhog Day. Well, in actual fact, I've got no experience in the nuclear industry. I've got experience in nuclear technologies, having served on board submarines, but never actually worked for a nuclear industry company. So I guess I'm really the newbie here. So I ran into these nice people at a meeting last Tuesday night. Virginia has a utility company named Dominion Resources, or at least it's mostly in Virginia, and they're working on building a third unit at North Anna, which is a two-unit site right now, originally designed to be a four-unit site, and it's located on a beautiful lake about 80 miles outside of Washington, D.C. The lake didn't exist before the plants were built because the lake is actually the waste heat treatment facility for the reactor plants. So each one of us made it to the meeting, and I think at least three of us spoke. Did you speak, Joe?
No, I did not.
And why not?
Oh, man.
I'll give you a chance now. What would you have said if you had spoken?
You know, I really don't know at this point.
So you've been to these kind of meetings before.
This was my third or fourth. And I guess this was the first one at which I had not spoken. So I was kind of like, I guess I wanted to try not speaking for a while.
So what?
I really can't say why I didn't speak, or, you know, it's just a matter of not really having anything to say.
So at the meeting, there were a number of people that shared some concerns, and, of course, some people that shared support for the facility. You all have been to the meetings before, and I guess, Kelly, you've even developed some recognition and understanding of what some of the people will say almost every time they get up. So what are some of the objections that people have to citing a new clean, reliable energy source on Lake Anna?
There are a number of people that come out to the public meetings that don't live in the local county. Now, that's not true of all of the ones that object, and certainly that's less true lately than it has been in the past. Initially, most of the objections came from people that lived in Charlottesville, which is about 35 or 40 miles away. And they would come out basically in objection to nuclear power in general. And their initial arguments were always based on the radioactivity and the releases that were involved and the health hazard to the public. And I found it very interesting. Does anybody remember hearing any objection on any of those grounds last week? I don't recall any of them.
I guess the objection about spent fuel solution increasing the amount of spent fuel that's going to be there.
Yeah, I heard waste. I heard some objections about waste. I did hear one or two objections about security. I heard maybe one person mention the increase in potential of a terrorist target. But the overwhelming objections that I recall hearing, and you all are free to correct me if I'm wrong, were based on the effects on lake temperature and lake level and what would happen to the existing recreational lake if there were a drought and how it affects the recreation on the lake, how it affects the landowners on the lake, how this third unit will basically affect this lake, which is this beautiful resource that we have here in Central Virginia, and we should work to preserve that, and what impact this third nuclear unit will have on that. So I thought it was kind of fascinating that other than waste, I don't remember hearing any objections to radiation, local health hazards, you know, all these other things that they started out with initially, which tells me that kind of, and there were people there that have been there from the very beginning whose objections were radiation is bad for you and you can't contain it and it'll get out of control and it'll do all these things. And those people that have been there all along didn't say that this time. They said water temperature, lake level, all these other things. There were individuals in particular that did not, try the old arguments. They're with much newer arguments because it's just whatever, the popular thing is that they think will grab headlines or carry the most weight. Or what it reveals to me is that their objection to nuclear is emotional rather than logical. And I'm not saying that that's bad or wrong because emotions are real too. But I don't want my regulators, I don't want the people in leadership positions to be deciding where my electricity will come from on an emotional basis. I want the scientific studies and the logic and the hard facts to back that up.
Well, of course, I have nothing against using emotion since I'm passionately interested in nuclear power being built rather than continuing to burn 1.2 billion tons of coal per year in the U.S. So I guess I do have emotions on the other side, on the pro side. I wonder if part of the reason that most of the comments were focused on those environmental issues that you talked about was that the primary focus in a meeting was on the environmental impact statement regarding
the site.
That's
a really good point, Rod. I suppose I hadn't given enough consideration to that since that was the focus of the meeting. The purpose of the meeting was to talk about the draft environmental impact statement for the combined operating license, the construction and operating license that Dominion is applying for North Anna Unit 3.
Yeah, so, if that's the purpose of the meeting, those folks that are well-briefed and trying to make their voices heard are often very focused on meeting the intent of the meeting. The first guy that spoke when I first arrived was going in great detail through chapter and verse about his objections to various ways that the environmental impact statement was constructed and the fact that it referred to the, isn't there already a site approval?
They already have approval for the early site permit.
That's what I'm thinking, early site permit.
Yeah, for people who are unfamiliar with the process, with the new licensing process for building a new nuclear reactor, there's three pieces to it. In theory, there's three pieces to it. If you exercise all parts of the process, then the first piece that you would get would be an early site permit, which is good for 20 years, that says this site is a reasonable place to put a nuclear power station of X size and X output, and they sort of come up with this bounding envelope for what will, you know, what will fit on this site. And so, okay, this site gets approval. Another piece of the licensing process is the construction and operating license, which says with design A and an approved early site permit, the construction and operating license is a request for approval to build a certain design. Now, the funky part in this particular case is the design that Dominion is pursuing to put on this site so far has not been licensed, because that's the third piece, is that you have that you use a licensed design that says this is an approved, safe design. This is a reasonable way to build a nuclear power station. This design will work, and it has all the safety features that the NRC requires and that kind of thing. So what Dominion is doing is they are pursuing a construction and operating license. In theory, while their architect engineer company, which is General Electric in this case, is pursuing licensing for the ESBWR, the Engineered Simple Economic Simplified Boiling Water Reactor. So Dominion's construction and operating license has selected a design that's not yet approved, but it's going through NRC approval in parallel. And then there are other rumors floating that Dominion is also implementing a competitive process to find out what kind of financial values are out there for other designs. So some of that came up at the meeting, that there are rumors floating that Dominion is not going to. Why is the NRC evaluating it? And
yeah, you know, it's interesting that you bring up there was a lot of mention of, well, Dominion's not even sure what kind of plant they want to buy. I mean, the reality is that Dominion knows that they need a power plant, and if they focus too early or they commit too early or too much to one design, that, you know, it's like shopping for a car and going to a dealership and say, well, I'm going to buy a Cadillac, you know, SUV, and of course at that point, you know, the dealer, if he's the only guy in town selling Cadillac SUVs, then he knows he's got you.
So. Right. He can do a $5,000 markup right there before he ever starts negotiating. And in the meantime, whatever Dominion does, Dominion is not this freewheeling entity. They're going to have to answer to the state regulators for what they select and how they reasonably spend ratepayers' money. So they're going to have to be able to prove to the state regulators that the design and the choice that they've made is in the best interest of their customers. So when they go to the SEC, they need to be able to come in with other numbers. We looked at other designs and we looked at other financial outlays, and this is how we know that we're providing the best value to the customers when they get through the process. The reality is right now we don't know what this other, you know, competitive financial process will reveal, but they don't decide all off on their own because they're regulated, and they need to prove to the state that they are reasonably accounting for what's in the ratepayer's best interest.
So Virginia is still a rate-regulated territory. Is that correct?
In Virginia.
Yeah, somebody help me with this.
Dominion has re-regulated its electricity generation in Virginia. Dominion owns plants outside the Virginia service area, if you will. And two of those are nuclear. I mean, the Millstone unit and the Kewaunee units are what they refer to as merchant plants. But for North Anna purposes, Dominion is now regulated, you know, utility to the offices of the state corporation.
Yeah, for people who say, wait a minute, that's not what I heard, and I thought that was different, it was different. Virginia was one of the states deregulating their electric utilities, and they had rate caps in place and they did everything they could do to encourage competition. And the reality was that at about that same time, electric rates were going up all over the country and competition didn't develop. And then Virginia, the state of Virginia, saw what happened in some of the neighboring states when they finally lifted the caps and went straight to less regulated electric utilities and how expensive their rates got, because they had to, and Virginia said, wait, we need to rethink this. This is not good for our constituents.
Yeah, like in Maryland, where
I live. The current market.
In Maryland, the rate for electricity went from 5.2 cents per kilowatt hour to 11.7 cents per kilowatt hour.
Oh, ouch.
That's for generation. And, of course, there was a tremendous amount of angst about that, logically so. And it was particularly from, I mean, I live in an all-electric house, so it was quite shocking. So, Mick, you've been kind of quiet. Why were you at the meeting?
Well, one of those, I guess, just interested in hopefully helping push forward the nuclear renaissance. And before I forget, one of the things I really enjoyed was they had the one poem, I forget who the author was, about it was quite anti-nuclear. And I think, Rod, you pointed out that the writer itself actually, worked for a pro-coal lobby, so it made sense.
That right, he would the E.F. Schumacher comment.
Oh, E.F. Schumacher, okay.
Yeah, I also have done some additional research. Remember the guy who held up the report from the American Physical Society?
Yeah,
that was Donald Day.
Donald Day.
Yeah, I went and read that report. That report mentions the fact that nuclear electricity is important if you're going to be conserving electricity and plugging in electric hybrids, and I think it mentions nuclear 28 times in the course of the report. So he might like the idea that the report mentions that you can save a little electricity at the peak through demand management, but it also very clearly recognizes the importance of nuclear power. So I wonder if he's actually read the report or not.
Well, it's funny. It seems that a lot of these opponents only read what they like to read and basically stop. And
well, I think Donald probably read the whole thing. He just repeated the parts that he liked.
Oh, okay.
I've heard him speak before.
I mean, there's definitely a bias where they cherry pick that I've noticed in this and other cases. I mean, for example, the Richmond Times-Dispatch, if I counted, it seemed like there was more positive people, so maybe I've got, you know, rosy-tinted glasses on, the negative, and only the negative ones got quoted. But maybe that's just, you know, some of the mainstream media as well.
In the Richmond Times-Dispatch?
Yes.
I thought I saw at least one article where they were they printed a quote from Wayman Bishop, who was representing a small business association here in the county, and he was the one who stood up and said that he had lakefront property and his recreation hadn't been affected, and he thought that another nuclear unit and low-cost clean electricity would be good for businesses in the area. But I thought Times Dispatch was the one that printed his quote. Maybe I've missed it.
I think his quote was the last one that got printed in that article. But it's I think there were like three or four negative ones, and then at least they ended with a positive one.
Oh, and I need to make another correction, too, because, Rod, when we started this out, you talked about been going to these meetings long enough to recognize the faces and the message that most people come from. I don't want to misstate my position either. There are people here in the county that have been lifelong opponents of the nuclear power station, and at least one of those spoke at the meeting. That would be Jerry Rosenthal, and his objections are usually interesting to listen to, if nothing else. He's a common figure not just at the public meetings, but shows up regularly at the Board of Supervisors meetings, and I can appreciate the fact that his feelings are deeply held, and that he is willing to support them. He's not just a fair weather friend. He has he has a message that he delivers on a regular basis and at every opportunity.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I got to be clear. I have a fair amount of sympathy for those people who live in fairly rural areas where the road infrastructure is, you know, generally two-lane roads, and their concern about a very large construction project that will bring in, you know, 2,000 to 5,000 workers, I guess, at various times over the course of that project, bring in lots of large equipment. I mean, there are things to be concerned about, and I'm sure that Dominion is, you know, planning ahead and trying to make sure they minimize the impacts. But that objection was raised when I went to the Calvert Cliffs meeting several months ago, because it is it's a small, you know, area. The whole county only has a population of about 80,000 people, and there's only one road in and out. Of course, Calvert Cliffs has an advantage. They could deliver everything by bay if they wanted to.
Well, Rod, that's not a nuclear issue. If you build anything in the county, it's going to impact the infrastructure and roads.
Well, there's no doubt about that, but of course the county residents could say, well, we're doing our share. Somebody else needs to build a power plant somewhere.
Yeah, but by the same token, if you want to attract a better tax base to your county, if that means large construction, that's not a nuclear issue. That's you know, providing education for your grandchildren so that there's a tax base there when your kids send their kids to school, that kind of thing.
How did the Calvert Cliffs meeting compare?
Well, at Calvert Cliffs, the number of objectors was much lower. I think it's possibly because they don't have a large university town nearby where they can, you know, hire some young – I'm sorry, where they can attract some students to come to the meeting. That's a slip of the tongue. Of course, you know, we all know that some of the folks that represent groups like Sierra Club or Greenpeace or whatever may be professionals who are being paid to be at the meeting. But
we have had the benefits of professionals that travel nationwide come out and speak at some of our meetings.
Yeah, like Paul Gunter. I was surprised he wasn't
like him. I did miss him this week. I'm sorry he couldn't make it out to see us.
Yeah. So up at Calvert Cliffs, there was a huge number of organized groups like chambers of commerce or church groups or business associations from various counties that will all be, you know, positively impacted, and they were all very favorable. And of course, you know, some of the people like at North Anna, some of the people who spoke against the project had moved into the area long after the power plants that are there were constructed, and long after all of the benefits from those power plants had made the county a much nicer place to live. Like you say, Kelly, you know, a large capital asset like a nuclear power plant is a huge local property tax payer. I think in Calvert County, the plants there represented as much as 75% of the local tax base at various times when they were in their early years before the rest of the county started developing.
Kelly, have you had the experience with the school system in the surrounding county outside of Louisiana?
I have, yes.
It's amazing how much that tax support goes into, and schools are just one example. I mean, what Louisa County has when you compare it to the surrounding county, it's pretty impressive.
I'm pleased with it. I don't have any issues with the local school system, but of course, since I have four children in it, and we know a lot of other kids in it, and a lot of other parents, it's not difficult to find people that have had problems with it, but I'm real pleased at the services they provide for my kids and at the involvement the teachers have in what my kids can achieve. And I know that that's you know, some of that is pay. You can attract good people with higher pay. Some of that is facilities and stuff like that. I've seen people that have really good people that have devoted lifelong careers to being interested in the kids and stuff like that, and then see them, it sounds kind of weird, it's hard to explain, but see them rewarded by the county growing to the point where they can put in facilities that come up alongside the time and effort that the teachers have invested and stuff like that. You know, if you couldn't afford a music teacher for the kids, well, you know, that's not essential. That's not one of the three R's, but the kids really do benefit from that, and they really do blossom from that, and they learn a lot. There's a lot more vistas that are open to the kids that really excel in music when you're able to provide some instruction for them in that vein and find out who's really good at it and who really needs more investment. If you don't even ask the question, then it's hard to find out who those kids are that need to advance in areas that really are not core curriculum, but the kids will still do really well in it and pursue it maybe careers later.
So, Kelly, right now, do you feel as a parent that there are opportunities for your children to actually get jobs and continue living in Louisa County if that's where they choose to live?
Yes. My kids will have opportunities in Louisa County, and the people that, I mean, I used to be employed by the utility. I'm not anymore, but I know plenty of people that still are. I know their kids now that are working at the power station, and I had kind of mixed feelings about that when I first started seeing my coworkers' children coming to work at the power station, and I came to the conclusion that, you know, I would just love for my kids to do that if they chose to do that. But I also want to make sure that they get enough education and they can do it in this county, that they can work anywhere they want. They're not stuck, if you will, working at the local power station. It's not like that's the only alternative there. But the education is good enough in the county that they can go wherever they want and do whatever they want. And that's kind of the beauty of having a nuclear neighbor, because they need technical people. And if you can produce an education system that will feed the employment system for the local employer, they are the largest employer in the county, then you're also feeding technical education for kids and young people that can go anywhere. A technical education is good no matter where they want to go.
Yeah, I got an employer who will send them all over the world if they're willing to go.
Yeah.
So, Mick, you said you're into the uranium mining business. Are you associated with Coles Hill?
No, not Coal. Associated with a little venture down here in Pennsylvania County. To hopefully look at, you know, potentially bringing uranium mining to the state. And one of the things that is kind of interesting is I wonder, you know, at the very beginning when North Anna was around, was there opposition? One of the stories that I always hear down here in Southside is the little town of Gretna thought it was going to be the end of the world when they were going to put in Smith Mountain Dam, you know. And now Smith Mountain Lake is one of the biggest tourist attraction spots, and in fact, the town is trying to reconfigure itself to be the gateway to Smith Mountain Lake. And it's just, you know, after a while, people almost take stuff for granted. From what I understood from some of the old-timers, that, you know, in the 40s and 50s, there was a little bit of touch and go there. They were afraid the dam was going to let go and flood the countryside, and now, you know, nobody mentions it. So that kind of makes it a little bit interesting as well.
Well, opposition to change is human nature. At least in some parts of humans, they get very comfortable and like where they are and don't want anything to change. I mean, I've many times moved to an area, because I've lived in probably a dozen places over the years, and not too long after you get there, you find that there are lots of people trying to roll up the sidewalks and prevent anybody else from coming in. That was always the case down in Florida. And then, of course, there are other folks that are interested in developing businesses and building an infrastructure and raising their children and stuff. And it's, and you know, like you say, Kelly, I think it's an important part of small towns if you can have a fully functioning education system and economy, so the children who grow up there actually have the option of staying in their hometown if they want, or taking the skills they learn there and going someplace else, and maybe coming back later when they want to raise children themselves.
Well, I also think, I was going to mention, you know, the farming heritage in Virginia. One of the big things, I know from personal experience with my father-in-law and mother-in-law, my father-in-law used to work at the naval plant in Lynchburg, and the only way they could afford to have an orchard was for the two of them to work during the day and then work on the orchard at night. And, you know, there are plenty of people who do the same thing where, you know, during the day, you've got the day job, and then basically your night or morning job is either your farm or your cattle or something like that. So if you want to keep a farm or some agricultural tradition, you know, having a good employer is something that's definitely able to promote something like that.
Yeah, isn't it funny that having a good employer in the county can make your dreams come true, even if that means you want to live off your own farm?
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, the converse, of course, is if you don't have a good employer, what happens? You know, a lot of people, unfortunately, don't make that much money off farming to be able to sustain themselves and their kids, and, you know, it becomes tough. You know, they might have to leave and go other places to find employment and so forth. So it's a way to enable people to actually stay in a place if they choose to do so.
And, of course, the other thing that, you know, I've spent a lot of time in small-town America and going around in various places. One of the really neat things about a facility like a nuclear power plant is that it's really a generational employer. You know, those plants are probably going to be there for a good 60 years from the time they're constructed, and probably provide employment for at least 5 years before they're operating, and at least probably 10 or 15 years after they're operated. So, you know, it's just an asset that's going to be around for a very long time. And, of course, I'm sure that's what worries some of the people, that, you know, they are worried that that asset will be there. So one of the challenges that I have is trying to figure out how to watch what the opposition has done against nuclear power and see if we can learn from those techniques to turn them to the positive side. What kinds of things do you think are the most effective when the opposition gets up and says their piece?
Well, see, I don't know about, I don't look at it from an effectiveness standpoint, and I probably should. But what bothers me is that the opposition gets up and they look like they have a lot more fun. And it just bothers me that we can't have fun when we get up there to speak. Why is that? I guess we're so concerned with being taken seriously, and I suppose there is something to that. I suppose out of the two, I would rather be taken seriously.
So you're not going to get up there and make out with your husband?
No, I'm probably not going to do that.
This is an inside joke, but it did sort of break down the house when we were there, and a young lady got up to speak and said, "Well, instead of speaking, I want to dramatize the relationship between the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Dominion."
Yeah, and I need a volunteer from the audience.
Of course, she had a ringer in the audience.
Yeah, exactly. How peculiar that the volunteer got up and moved down to the front at the same time she was called up to speak. He's like, "Oh, yeah, I'll volunteer."
Well, I think the answer to your question is the emotional message. I mean, isn't that basically what the opposition is able to play on the best? Either from, you know, almost crying on stage to making everyone laugh on, you know, in the audience. Well, you know, if you've got a technical background, you're supposed to be kind of cut and dry. So it's kind of tough. You know, you raise a great thing about having fun. You know, it's that fine line. You've you're trained, you know, you're supposed to deliver a serious message seriously, but it doesn't mean in a public forum, you know, maybe that's one thing proponents should practice a little more. I mean, Rod, I thought your speech was excellent at the very end. You know, when you kind of gave A through Z, your experiences in the Navy and, you know, how much waste fuel is left after a submarine's done cruising the ocean. But, you know, a lot of people, unfortunately, that have been trained in, it's not just the nuclear industry, other industries, any kind of scientific venture, you know, you kind of get into that, I don't know, you'd call it the nerd zone almost, where you don't really have too much fun with it. You were never trained to do that.
Well, see, I think the main word in your phrase was cut and dry. We just can't be dry.
Yeah.
See, here's Robert Margolis. I'm sorry that he can't be in this phone conversation, and I'm sorry that he couldn't be at the meeting last week, but he had to move away from us, the slug. We'll forgive him just this once. But he has told me many times, and he's going to be disappointed that I can't remember the fancy words that he always teaches me for it, but there are three ways of appealing or persuading to an audience to change their mind. And the one that the antis like to use, the one that our opposition uses most often, is the emotional appeal. So they'll get up there, or they'll cry, or they'll laugh, or, you know, have something. And that will really only hold your attention so long. You know, that's the fear-mongering, oh, this, you know, is terrible, and how can you let your children be exposed to this, and this kind of thing. The one that might hold your attention and might carry a little more weight, a little longer than that, is the logical appeal, which is the route that I go most often. But with too many dry facts and stuff, people get turned off and they stop listening. And now the logical appeal is not really carrying any weight with them either, because they can't absorb it all. They're not going to take the time to do the investigation and learn it for themselves. But what carries them, and this was what Rob said at the meeting, it was a shame that he was the last one to speak, is basically the is if you trust me as a speaker, then take my word for it, because of who I am and what my experience is, that I know this is okay. And that was the position that Rod got up and spoke from. You know, I lived for, how many years? Fill in the numbers for me, Rod.
5.5 years.
Five and a half years within how close to the reactor?
200 feet. Within, you know, 200 feet. The ship was only 400 feet long.
Breathe the air. It was used to purify my water, and, you know, there's no effects. I think this is one of the best power systems out there. It's the smallest with, you know, the waste issue. The waste is one of the best things that nuclear power has going for it, because there's less waste with nuclear power than there is with just about any other large baseload electricity source, except possibly for hydro. And if you want to talk about environmental damage, that's pretty significant. But waste really is the biggest benefit that nuclear has going for it. If you say that the waste from a nuclear power plant, the really nasty, hazardous, deadly stuff, is deadly for 300 years, how long do you think the waste, the toxic waste from a coal plant, is deadly? Forever. It never gets better. But you don't hear forever compared with 300 years or 10,000 years or whatever number you want to pick. The waste from nuclear keeps getting less and less toxic the more you isolate it from the environment. The waste from coal stays toxic forever. It never gets better. You know, what other industry do you hear about that toxins continue to improve the longer you just let them sit on a shelf? Nuclear is the only one. And yet they act like this is the Achilles heel.
David Lockbaum was interviewed once, and he was asked why the anti-community, you know, there were certain risks certainly prevalent with the chemical industry. And he was asked why the anti-community wasn't going after the chemical industry with the same fervor that they were the nuclear industry. And his quote was, well, we can't do without the chemical industry. And what they're doing is they're picking their target. And they've sort of set the nuclear industry as this target through which they can monger fear and get support. The other point
I lost my train of thought. But that was an interesting insight from him at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Yeah, I think that the there will always be support for folks that want to fight against nuclear power. There's no doubt in my military mind that from a market point of view, there's a lot of folks that have a lot to lose if they let nuclear power succeed. And those people sell coal, they sell oil, they sell gas. They sell wind turbines. They sell CFLs, compact fluorescent light bulbs.
I honestly don't think natural gas people have anything to lose. They will always have a market. Natural gas is one of those universally useful sort of things. But, yeah, the rest of it I can go along with. And they sell compact fluorescent bulbs.
The key is not that they will that nuclear will push natural gas out of the marketplace. The key is that nuclear power will reduce the price at which natural gas will sell. I mean, take a look at how the market price varies for natural gas, and you can see that it started to go up. The more natural gas electric power plants got built, the more the price of gas went up because the demand for it was exceeding the supply at that price.
Right.
The only way to increase the supply or to change the supply was to push some folks out of the market by pricing them out of the market. I mean, back in the 1990s, when 1996, when everybody said, let's build gas plants, the price of natural gas was $1.80 per million BTU. Last summer, it got to $15. It's back down now to about 7 or 8, but that's still pretty high.
Going back to your question about how we can do things, to counter the anti. One example, and I guess this is by way of a plug, is this summer, as it has been for, I guess, in 3 or 4, and then for years back beyond that, there was a short hiatus. The American Nuclear Society hosts a 4-day science teacher workshop on the nuclear power and radiation, the science of radiation. And we bring in science teachers from middle and high school all over the state of Virginia and other localities, basically given, and they get CEUs. And it's always been amazing to me when they finally start to hear, and this is the science, and this is taught at a scientific level. So it's, as you will, cut and dried. But it amazes me how when they get their eyes open, it's, why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we doing this? What's the problem here? And trying to open them up. And it quickly evolves into outside of the science and into the politics. Oh, the point I wanted to make earlier, and this goes back to how some of the anti-talk and specifically with regard to waste, the point that gets me is you very rarely hear the antis talking about volume. You hear them talking about weight. You always hear about tons and tons of waste. And when you try and point out that, a ton of uranium doesn't take up that much space because it's the heaviest element known, natural. It kind of deflates the argument, but they still want to use this exclamatory, there's tons and tons of this stuff. And I've always found that to be an interesting ploy.
Yeah, I like to compare it to the tons and tons of waste products that come spewing out of a coal-fired power plant every day. A single 1,000-megawatt coal-fired power plant produces 45,000 tons of waste out into the atmosphere every day. And of course the total amount of used nuclear fuel, or what people call high level waste, is less than 70,000 tons, and that's for all of the plants for all of the 50 years they've been operating.
Okay.
It's a pretty dramatic difference.
you rarely get the opportunity to, you know, express that difference. Yeah, I heard an interesting little factoid about the fact that the effluent from a coal stack is radioactive, and if, say, Dominion was forced to monitor their coal plant according to, you know, the radiation protection requirements they have on their nuclear plants, they probably have to shut them down. But the little factoid said the fact that if you, and I don't do the numbers, but if you took the uranium out of the coal, you'd probably get more energy than you are burning the coal.
I haven't
done anything like calculation. And Mick, I guess, you know, this is your area, you know, the cost of having to refine that, you know, mine it, separate the uranium and the other fissile or fertile material out of the coal. But it was an interesting little, you know, factoid.
Go
ahead.
No, we keep talking. I was just going to mention it is a lot of quantity. I mean, you think about a unit train of coal, you know, what, 100 cars is equivalent, you know, to just keeping a plant operational for a little while. You know, a coal plant, while a nuclear plant can go, you know, easily 18 months on average with just a reload, and that's a third of the reactor.
So, Mick, you mentioned that you're not associated with coal, and there's another uranium possibility there in Virginia. I hadn't heard about that. But what's the status for mining uranium in Virginia?
Right now there is a moratorium in place, and, you know, the word moratorium is supposed to be a delay. And in 1984, a company called Marline came out with a study that the state of Virginia, in fact, there's the Coal and Energy Commission, completed to look at the possibility of, you know, uranium mining. The study was finished then, and Marline actually found the coal deposit in 1979. And then there's the Chatham Fault comes across the state, and in the southern part of the state, they found a large uranium deposit. And then they went through all the steps, and before the state wanted to allow uranium mining to go forward, they wanted to do an extensive study. And they did. It took them about 3 or 4 years. When they came back, 15 out of 17 of the state legislators and others that were on the Uranium Administrative Group basically recommended lifting the moratorium and allowing the implementation of mining regulations. Now, the problem was, at that time, if you look at the price of uranium, it was in free fall. And essentially, it dropped to a point where it was no longer economically viable for Marline to continue to pursue the project. So they basically pulled it up shop, went home, and the Commonwealth looked around and said, well, if no one's going to mine the stuff now, you know, there's no need to lift the moratorium, so just leave it in place. Now, if you move forward to a couple of years ago, the price of uranium started to go back up again. And the main reason is a lot of the inventories that were released that caused the fall in the price of uranium started to, you know, basically disappear. 1979 was obviously a tough year for the nuclear industry with Three Mile Island, which followed, you know, a lot of cancellations. So the uranium industry took quite a clobbering. But finally, you know, if you look at primary uranium production and the use in the power plants, there's a discrepancy. The mines don't produce as much as the plants actually need. So there's a fairly decent inventory draw that's still going on, which is partially good news with the program called Megatons to Megawatts, where our government and the Russian government have a program to downblend military surplus uranium that the Russians have, but that ends in 2013, so an interesting dynamic occurs after that. I'll probably talk too much. I don't know if you all were aware of that. I used to work on the Megatons to Megawatts program, so I can talk your ears off about that as well. I mean, it's a great program.
because you came in just the right point. If you hadn't mentioned it, I was going to, because it fit right there where you were.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, it's coming to an end, but fortunately it also reminds us that we basically have to start looking at, you know, what do we do next? You know, the most logical and economic way to fill the nuclear fuel cycle is with mined uranium. And then you can, you know, as the prices start to go up, look at reprocessing, because obviously it costs a lot more to reprocess uranium than to get it straight out of the ground, especially if you've got a good resource. But, you know, all of this stuff has to be kind of brought to bear.
Okay, now, can I interrupt with a couple questions?
Sure.
Because I have some concerns about uranium mining, and I'll let you know that the basis of my concerns are first and foremost in ignorance. So I have, you know, anecdotes that I've collected from people that I've met about indigenous peoples out west that I believe. I don't think that I was led astray, that in all sincerity there were people that were harmed in the first uranium rush. And it's easy for me to see how that happened, because the first uranium rush was primarily military in nature, and the stockpile of uranium that caused the price crash that you talked about was that was left over from the military needs, that they didn't need as much as they had stockpiled, and now they were making it available and essentially flooding the market to power companies that would be able to use the uranium and make electricity from it. And that was a kind of a national security issue. Cheap electricity benefited everybody. There was no harm in doing that. But now I sort of want to bring my understanding up to modern day. The highest quality, as I understand it, please correct me if I'm wrong, the highest quality uranium that I know of that's available comes either from Canada or Australia. Is that true?
Correct.
That's
for the
true.
Current market?
Yes, yes. And the Canadians get up to 20% ore grade, which is incredible. You know, the way you do mining is, you know, it's a percentage. When you look at your ore, how many pounds of uranium per ton of rock, basically, that you got to get out of the ground. And so the Canadians are able to get, you know, 200, very high ore grades, where it's very pure uranium. Now, let me just step back on the question of indigenous peoples. You know, in the 50s and 60s, it wasn't just uranium mines that basically didn't get mining right. If you look at coal mines, you look at black lung, anybody who did underground mining at that time was in fairly horrible conditions.
Great.
You know, in 1969, new mining regulations came around where basically you had to have adequate ventilation in the mines. And one of the things that got the uranium miners was the radon gas. Obviously, you're inside a large uranium body, so you're going to have radon flux. There are ways to mitigate it, just like there are ways to mitigate, you know, coal dust, but it's got to be mitigated. We know we got to do that now, so that's what's done. You don't just send miners in there willy-nilly, where before it was a lot more loosey-goosey what the rules were. And now,
right,
of course, it's got to be a lot more regulated. And unfortunately, the way you learn is on the, you know, lessons of the past.
Don't the Canadians use some sort of remote mining techniques in some of their areas because they're so high in uranium ore content?
Yeah, they have to do some shielded work, and then they do processing on the ground.
And the other interesting thing with the Canadians is some of their deposits are essentially in bogs, so they have to freeze the ground, and that's what they ran into trouble, I believe it was Cigar Lake, where they've got water ingress. They had to literally freeze the ground to the point that they can cut through it. Otherwise, it's just too sloppy.
Yeah, of course, there's some other complicating factors with this stories about the indigenous peoples. One of the things that's pretty evident from the health effects is that the combination of cigarette smoke and radon is... they seem to add to each other.
Yep.
Most of the folks that had bad health effects were both smokers and exposed to radon in higher quantities. So that's That seems to be a real issue. Maybe it's because your lungs that are weakened are more susceptible. But the other thing that is interesting to me is that the Navajo tribe, which was the one who was supposedly the most affected, is terribly anti-nuclear from an official point of view. But the Navajo tribe that has very strict laws against not mining uranium on their land because it's a violation of the sacred land, has more than 60% of their income is from mining coal, and another 20% is from allowing coal-fired power plants to be built on their land.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so to me, if you're worried about the earth being violated, it really doesn't matter what kind of mining. And I guess I say that same kind of thing about Virginia. You know, a state that has a moratorium on mining uranium has 147 active coal mines.
Well, and also they've got a lot. There's a lot of quarries in Virginia. One interesting story I can tell you. What was it? A couple months ago, they wanted to put in a quarry just south of Lynchburg, one of the quarry companies. And we went to the hearing at the Board of Supervisors, and it was incredible how many people came out in opposition to just basically a quarry. And they accused the quarry operator of everything under the sun, from, you know, blasting at night, which obviously they can prove isn't true. And the interesting thing was some of those opponents said, well, you know, just watch my YouTube tape, and you can see the ground shaking at like 2 a.m. Well, you know, you could basically tape anything you want, put it on YouTube. But it was just, I guess, the level of
credibility.
Yeah, I was going to say credibility, but I mean, the question is, they just make stuff up, you know, which is just incredible. There's like no fact check police or anything like that, and I guess that's what they figure. There's nobody who's going to really call into the mat on it, so they'll just throw it all out there. No, I mean, these guys, the Division of Minerals, Mines, and Energy, you know, they regulate when you can blast. And that protects the company as well as the people, because the last thing you want to do, if you're a company, is get in trouble over something like that. It just isn't worth it.
Now, you may have misunderstood my question, or you may have answered it accurately. My question is, they thought they could just throw out whatever information they made up get away with it. Nobody would question them. Were they right? Were they called on the false information that they put forward?
I think there were so many people putting false information forward. You know, nobody individually went out, you know, try to correct that. The good news was that the vote came out in favor of the quarry, but it was incredible that it would have taken 2 days worth of testimony. Everybody and their cousin had to get up there and, you know, complain about this and that. And yet, one of the main things that the quarry company tried to remind people of was, if you want to build houses or roads or anything, you do need quarries, you know, the basic infrastructure of industrial economies. But I guess some people just want to be heard.
Now, and that's true. There are some people that just want to be heard. But here's what we've learned by being persistent and having a presence that is committed to continue showing up at meetings when you have a long drawn out process, something that's not just a 1 or 2 day hearing and then it's over and done with, is that you will have people that come out that just want to be heard, and they will quite frankly make stuff up, or they will take things that are half true, and then they will present that to an audience that doesn't know how to tell what is credible information, what's not credible information. But if you're committed to getting the truth out to members of the public, and you can say, they say this, let me tell you the rest of the story is this, that, and the other, you don't have to counter every false argument they make. And they can make hundreds and thousands of them if they want to. But you don't have to counter all of them. You pick the biggest ones, and you answer the biggest ones, and you show up consistently every time they do, and they will stop putting out false statements because they know there's somebody there to call them on it. And their arguments will change and morph, and it's okay that they change and morph, because at least they will change and morph to facts. They won't be selling these wild stories and fear-mongering and this, that, and the other. They will become more fact-based because it's because you have to be more attentive and more focused to call them on that, and they don't look so foolish when they're putting out their favorite spin facts as when they're making up stuff out of whole cloth, and you have someone to say, hey, you know, I've been around quarries before, or I've been around nuclear power stations before, or, you know, whatever. I have a background. I can tell you it's not the way they're making you think it is. And you, but you, if you have a group of people that have the freedom to speak and that can sit there and listen to hear what they say and come to the next meeting and say, I remember you from the last time, and you said this, and I can tell you it's not that way.
Hey, Kelly, one of the things that was talked about at the meeting was apparently there was somebody who was supposed to speak who had a baby and had to leave early. Was that somebody
yeah.
in favor or against?
That was in favor of Unit 3. In fact, I had hoped that she was going to be able to join this phone call. Obviously, with a new baby in the house, that was not going to work out. But that was Rebecca Falls.
Yeah, because one of the things that, you know, you talk about feeding on emotion, and I do get emotional about the importance of building nuclear power plants compared to continue to depend on coal. And I really, the other thing I'm trying to convince people is that the idea that storing used nuclear fuel is somehow giving a burden to future generations, I really like to think of that as giving them a tremendous already mined resource that once they're ready to start using it, it's already there, nicely packaged, ready to go, and it, as Patrick Moore is now saying, it contains 20 times the amount of energy as what we've already pulled out of it.
Absolutely. I was talking with speakers from maybe from France, because France has more experience reprocessing than the United States does.
Recycling. And, come on, recycling.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. Use the right word.
I appreciate the
right
correction.
Word.
But I was talking about the financial difference between recycling the used fuel versus taking it out of the ground directly, and it really is a financial consideration for the current cost of mining uranium. If recycling is about double that, which sounds like a lot, if you put it in perspective, if the current fuel costs are the smallest expense in running and operating a nuclear power station, because you only have to refuel every 18 months, if the fuel cost is the smallest expense, it currently runs about 8% of the cost of the electricity you get on the wholesale level for nuclear power. So if you double that, you're only talking about an 8% increase. You know, you're only talking about 8% increase in one of the least expensive sources of electricity in the first place. So even if recycling is not currently viable for where the uranium prices would have to come up to make it economically attractive, and the double benefit of the effectiveness is that it substantially reduces the amount of material left over that needs to be stored or isolated until you can dispose of it. So most of that, you know, 20 times the energy we've already gotten out of it, we can still reuse that again. Of course that's a resource to my children and to their children's generation. There's incredible amounts of energy still stored in there, and the prices don't have to come up to be exorbitant to make it cost effective to reuse that again. That's why the federal government didn't go with, for example, deep sea disposal or space disposal of nuclear waste. There are sound economic reasons for why they didn't just drill a hole and put it so far down deep in the ground that you never had to worry about pulling it back out again. Why didn't they do that? Because it's useful. You don't want to put it somewhere where you can never get it off the shelf again. There's still more energy in that, and technology will come along to where we can benefit from that and where our kids and our grandkids can benefit from that. You don't hide that from them and say, no, you can't have this. You know, you teach them to be responsible with it and they handle it reasonably, and then they have this tremendous resource that they can take advantage of.
I think you're giving the government more credit than they're due. Making decisions like that.
Right, because if they were really making a logical decision, they would have said, well, you know, it's not really that hazardous right where it is today, and if we don't spend any money moving it around the country, we would have the ability to eventually recycle it. You know, why bury it? I don't understand. I've never understood that.
The element to that, Rod, since 1983, the U.S. government has been getting 0.1 cent for every kilowatt of electricity generated using nuclear power.
Yeah, about $800 million a year.
Right.
And so why do I have to hear the anti talk about, you know, nobody has addressed the cost of waste? Yes, they have. There is a way, and it's included in the electric bill that you pay every month. The waste is already paid for.
Right, and the cost of it is 0.1 cent per kilowatt hour on a product that you pay somewhere between 5 and 20 cents a kilowatt hour, depending on where you live in the U.S.
Well, the contract was that the government was going to take the spent fuel 10 years ago, now 11. And it's resulted in the fact that utilities have now brought suit successfully against the federal government to be recompensated for their expenses that they've had to incur because the federal government hasn't taken the fuel as promised when they made the bargain to not recycle, if you will, the fuel. That was the devil's bargain. The Faustian bargain was, you know, Ford and Carter said, well, we're not going to recycle this fuel, but we realize that you're going to be generating it, so we'll find a place to put it. Well, we're still waiting.
Yeah, see, I really wish that the nuclear industry would act like adults and simply say, okay, you're not going to do that. We'll declare this contract null and void. We will take care of our own used material, and as a matter of fact, we consider it to be a resource, and thank you very much. Please cancel the contract and let us keep our used nuclear fuel fee, and we can do a lot with $800 million a year.
Rod, they tried to do that, and the courts prevented them.
Well, they just need to do it public. They need to keep doing it publicly and shame the government into explaining why it is they declare this a monopoly.
Okay, explain to me again why you don't think the government has the foresight to keep this resource available, but you think they can be shamed into doing anything? What makes you think the government has any shame?
You want to shame the government, Rod? Oh, I get it. Okay.
Hey, it can be done. Politicians get shamed all the time.
And how much impact does that have?
But the dry cast storage is already a solution, you know. I mean, the utilities have already come up with a solution they need until the government can finally get their act together, what, 50 years from now or whenever. You know, I guess the environmental movement's idea was to try to fill up all the spent fuel pools and hopefully stop up the utilities from the back end, and fortunately that didn't happen. You know, dry casks are all over the place now.
Right. That was an official policy by the Critical Mass Energy Project, was they said, we will use the waste issue to constipate the industry.
Yeah, and that's exactly true. Basically, that was why, that was the whole El Grande mosaic behind killing the recycling idea. They realized that if you start recycling the fuel, then all their anti-nuclear arguments were dead on arrival. So they were committed to the once through fuel cycle, so that they could make waste their banner issue. As long as we didn't have any answer for what to do with the waste, then they had a banner that they could wave and a drum that they could beat ad infinitum. As soon as you bring recycling into the picture, then all their arguments evaporate, and they've got no momentum for anything.
Yep, and you don't even have to recycle it all today or tomorrow or even you know, right away. All you have to do is say, you know, we've got this huge resource. We're building it up, and we know how to do it. Here's our demonstration. We will do it as it's economical. And, by the way, Kelly, I really believe it's economical today. The variation in price is simply not enough to say it's not economical. It adds about 1.3 mils to the price of electricity from a nuclear power plant.
I should have known you would have had the numbers.
It's nothing to be concerned about. I mean, it's, again, right now nuclear plants are generating for about 1.78 cents per kilowatt hour. So you add 1.3 mils to that, it makes it 1.85 cents per kilowatt hour. What's the big deal? Anyway, hey, folks, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat. Next time when I go to a public meeting, I'm going to arrive earlier so we can maybe all go out and have something, a bite to eat or something beforehand. And,
I
think it's important for people who are really passionately supportive of using nuclear power as a clean, reliable source of electricity to get out there and go to the meetings and talk to people. Try to not be completely cut and dry, particularly stay off the dry part, and share your knowledge. I mean, I know the people that listen to this show have got a lot of knowledge and experience, and it doesn't work to get up and kind of beat your chest and say, well, I know and you don't. It's just share your experience. Say, you know, what you're saying just doesn't match up with what I know. You know, when people talk about the nuclear industry, one of the amazing things is to go to meetings of utilities or to the American Nuclear Society and really talk to the people and find out just how dedicated they are to producing a product that people really want to buy. I mean, I can't think of another product where it makes the front page if people are not allowed to buy it for a few hours.
Particularly if they're in an elevator shaft at the time.
Yeah.
Any last words, folks?
Well, thank you. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. This was a fun group you put together, Rod. Thanks for having us.
So we went a little longer than normal, but I thought it was a great conversation. And if you have any free time or have any free change, please go and visit tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com/pledge and throw in a few bucks to the kitty. Keep the bandwidth flowing, keep the servers humming, and help my friend keep producing and enabling the distribution of independent thought from independent minds and help the world to evolve in its quest to seek and share information. Bye now.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
Yeah, I know that sounds really egocentric for a guy named Rod Adams to say the way is the Adams way, but it's really ATOMS, Atoms. The way is the Atoms way, and it's here today.
You're listening to the podcast network. Listen, learn, evolve.